Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
Our guest today is Chris Adig from Adig Curran Steele. He's based out of Little Rock, Arkansas, but he's a Texas lawyer, and we'll let him tell you more about that. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you guys for having me. I'm going to jump in real quick and thank you all for a wonderful podcast. I've listened to you all for quite some time. And two things I wanted to tell you, you guys are doing a great service to the legal profession and educating about appellate law, and your breadth of guests is phenomenal and has helped me quite a bit in my own practice. And your interview style is just phenomenal. I really enjoy the interviews and really appreciate the opportunity to be on here and be a part of this.
Thank you. We appreciate the feedback too. We're always happy to have some listeners come in and tell us they enjoy it.
That's right. Well, I guess that's the end of the show. We've heard everything we need to hear. Now that we've been,
that's really all I have stroked. To say.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no, we really do appreciate that, Chris. Thank you so much. It is meaningful to us. Well, let's do what we usually do, which is I'm going to kick it back to you and let you tell our guests about your background, sort of where you come from. I know you've got some unique experiences that we want to talk about. So let's just launch into it.
Try to give you a 30,000 battlefield view of the career here, but I got out of the Army. I guess it's probably the best place to start. Got off active duty in 1997, didn't really have a clue what I was going to do with my life going forward from there. Spent a little time homeless and then bounced around from job to job. And one day found myself in a warehouse in East Texas for Target, sorting toothbrushes to go to different retail outlets, and decided it was enough of doing that and sat down, spent a good bit of time focusing on what I wanted to do with my life, and ended up finding myself at South Texas College of Law down in Houston. Left school there, couldn't find jobs at the time. And so the only thing I was able to find was some work with the IRS, not tax law, thank God, but did some employment law with them and realized that there was an opportunity. There was nobody representing individuals suing the IRS for employment discrimination or suing for wrongful termination and those sorts of things. So I broke out, started my own practice. And a couple of years into that, I came down to Austin, Texas, saw a CLE on veterans law by Bart Stickman, who runs NVLSP, the National Veterans Legal Services Project. It was 2007. They had just opened up the practice to broader attorney representation. And after a one-day CLE, I was on the drive back up to Dallas and thought, this seems like it's well-suited for what I like to do with my life. I made the decision then to flip the practice. It took a couple of years to flip it from employment law to veterans law. Spent some time as a sole practitioner, and I've seen the ups and downs as a sole practitioner, as a firm manager now with two other partners. We've hit the highs and lows. Somebody once told me that the quickest way to find bankruptcy court was to represent veterans. And they're not wrong. Wow. I will tell you that. But fortunately, I didn't get that bad. But I've seen the lows of the profession. I've seen the highs of the business. And we've reshaped our practice here in the last few years to really focus heavily on the appellate law experience that the U.S. Court of Appeals veterans comes in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. So that's kind of everything, just the high notes of the career there. And I'll let you guys kind of dive in where you want to explore from there.
I do want to back up because we are the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, and you do have some Texas appellate experience clerking on the Supreme Court. Will you tell us a little bit about that?
When I was in law school, I took an opportunity to go over to Turkey. It was the summer before 9/11, and our law school, South Texas, had a program with the University of Marmara in Istanbul. And while I was over there, Chief Justice Tom Phillips was over there as part of that program, and he was doing some project with some lawyers over there to try to revise their penal code to modernize it. And during that opportunity, I had an opportunity to sit down and chat with the chief and get to know him and talk with him in a fairly, say the word intimate. I don't know that that's the best word for it, but you don't often get to sit down at a table and have lunch and chat freely with the chief justice of a state Supreme Court. And he encouraged me to apply for a program they had where a law student could come in and intern and clerk. I got accepted to that program, transferred to University of Texas Law School for a semester, and clerked in Chief Phillips' office. And that was my first introduction to appellate law. And I didn't realize then that the hook had been set, but it had been set. I had an opportunity to sit down there. I don't remember if it was mandatory, but it was strongly encouraged that all of his clerks go down and watch every oral argument. And so we all sat down there and watched. And it's a fascinating experience. And looking back on it, it is where the hook was set.
Now, that's tremendous. And so you came to UT as a visiting student for a semester and completed that program. That's really awesome. There are a lot of things to unpack from your self-introduction there. I want to go back even further and talk about your military experience. You mentioned being on active duty till 97. Had you completed your undergrad when you went in, or did you do it while you were there, or how did that go?
So I was in first year of undergrad up in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and I had a little bit of a problem with partying too much and studying too little. So the scholarships were lost in that first year. And opportunity presented itself to go and compete for a scholarship through ROTC, the Army ROTC program there. And I went to, I'll call it basic training light in Fort Knox, Kentucky, in I think it was the summer of 90, and was awarded a 3-year scholarship. And then from there, just went into the Army straight away out of college. So went into my officer basic in Fort Sill, Oklahoma. And then not too long after, found myself in South Korea with 2nd Infantry Division. And then spent 4 years on active duty doing a variety of things. I was always trying to get closer to the infantry world. I went to a Ranger school, spent a lot of time there, never got the tab, but spent enough time there to earn a couple of them had I applied myself. And then I was invited, this is back pre 9/11. So to get into Special Forces was largely invitation. And I was invited to come to Special Forces Assessment and Selection School and had a heart-to-heart with myself probably about a week before I was supposed to report and realized that this isn't what I wanted to do with my life. And so that's when I made the decision to get off active duty. Got off active duty in 97, spent some time in the reserves and individual ready reserves all the way up to 04. But that's where I kind of went through that rough period in the civilian world of trying to adapt that skill set or lack of any skill sets in the military to the civilian world.
Well, I'm sure now in hindsight, you look back and think, well, of course you go and become a lawyer representing veterans because that was your experience. I mean, we all have heard about Ranger School and how difficult all that is. And just, I admire someone who has the tenacity to actually go through and accomplish that. But what a neat way, I have to assume, for you to be able to relate to your clients. The fact that you actually were in active service and had that ROTC experience and then went in and went to South Korea. What a wonderful tool I'm sure you have in your toolbox to be able to directly relate to your clients.
It's in some ways a blessing and a curse because in some ways I can relate better to my clients. In other ways, it's more of a curse because it's a frustration because I've experienced the hardships of reintegrating into civilian life, just say it that way, is challenging whether you're a peacetime vet or a wartime vet. It's a huge challenge. And I've seen those struggles and I've seen how the law and veterans law broadly doesn't really consider that so much. It really kind of sticks strictly to this kind of administrative, regulatory, interpretive scheme and leaves a lot of the humanity out. So it's difficult for me to communicate sometimes to my clients what courts are trying to do when it looks like they're overlooking the humanity of the situation. But it's been fun. Sometimes I'll chat with a vet. We had one client who was a Korean War vet. So we spent hours on the phone comparing what Korea was like in the 1990s to what it was like in the 1950s. I've had clients that are former soldiers of mine that I've led. And that's a unique experience in and of itself, is to come full circle like that is pretty powerful in a lot of respects.
Westlaw Edge is the standard for legal research, bringing together a legacy of quality and accurate legal research and the latest advancements in technology. First of its kind features, like the next generation of legal search, intelligent document analysis, integrated litigation analytics, and the most powerful citator, expedite research tasks that were once incredibly complex and time-consuming. Westlaw Edge allows attorneys to deliver the fastest answers and gain the most valuable insights, providing a clear strategic advantage. Be a better attorney, make your firm better, and serve your clients better than you have before with Westlaw Edge. For those of us that don't really have familiarity, can you kind of explain, I mean, what are the types of veterans claims that you see? And then maybe just walk us through and explain how the process works.
Yeah, it's a massive, massive bureaucratic process. But the general concept is that when you're in military service and you suffer some sort of a disability, and that has a very specific meaning in our practice area, but when something happens to you in service that impairs your ability to get and keep work after service, you can file a claim for what's called service-connected disability benefits. There's a host of other benefits that are available through the VA, whether it's healthcare, caregiver programs, all sorts of different programs, vocational rehab, et cetera. But we really focus on that service-connected disability where a veteran's injury in service causes something to happen to them later in life. And so we pursue those claims. They're rated. It's very much like a workers' comp scheme in a lot of senses, is you're rated based on the percent of your disability, and that translates to a monthly dollar amount. And that dollar amount can continue for the rest of your life tax-free in almost every situation. And so those are the typical benefits that we pursue. Over the years, I've worked with a lot of different types of clients. When I first started the practice area, I was looking for something that I could do that was, for lack of a better phrase, scalable, in the sense that I didn't have to learn the whole area overnight. And so I focused really hard on a specific type of claim, sleep apnea claims, veterans suffering from sleep apnea as a result of their service. I ended up writing a book, which I probably have to go and update now. It's been a few years since I've written it, but teaching pro se vets how to do it for themselves, and grew a name for myself in that regard. And at the time, sleep apnea claims were considered the scam of veterans law. It's not a real disability. It's not a real disease. And that has significantly changed and has become a mainstay of many firms' practices. And now what we do is we really focus, we've got the appellate practice, and then we've got an agency practice, and we do different things. On the agency side, and this is when you file your claim with the VA, they review it, they make a decision, then you get an opportunity to appeal, primarily just to fulfill due process. You get an opportunity for a hearing at the Board of Veterans Appeals if you want one. And then you get a decision and it goes before an appellate tribunal. The Veterans U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is a congressional court. And then the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit reviews the Veterans Court's decision. And of course, they're a full-fledged U.S. appellate tribunal. But now at the agency level, we don't work so much the sleep apnea claims. We're working primarily with the victims of military sexual trauma. And we work with a lot of vets who are, I'll just be direct and blunt, we work with a lot of vets who are not white men. Because in the system, veterans who are Black, veterans who are Hispanic, female veterans, veterans who identify as LGBTQ, kind of get lost in the shuffle. Only 25% of veterans pursue their benefits through the VA. That's a rough number, but that's 3 out of 4 veterans don't. You can probably carve out 25% saying they're just make enough money, they don't feel the need to. But in the middle ground, what we're finding is a lot of veterans who are Black, a lot of veterans who are Hispanic and identify as LGBTQ, they're scared of the VA. They're scared to pursue those benefits because of the culture that exists there, the culture in the veterans community. And so we're doing a lot of work to reach out to those groups, to bring them into the fold, to get them the benefits they need, because they are, simply put, life-changing.
Gosh.
So the claims that are made to the VA, are they made sort of regionally, or is it all directed in DC? Like, I know you practice in a lot of different places and have clients from all over. Like, where does your practice actually occur for the most part?
So we actually do, we have an office here in Little Rock, which is where the firm's primary office is. We've got attorney, my partner's up in Rhode Island, Alexandra Curran. She's been practicing since 2012. Her husband served in, I always get confused whether it was Iraq or Afghanistan, but he was injured over there. And we also have an attorney down in North Carolina. We have paralegals that work with us out of Florida. And basically anywhere in the US, we can work. The claims themselves used to be handled regionally. Every state had at least one regional office for the Department of Veterans Affairs. Some states like Texas, California had more than one. They have changed that now, and now everything is handled through what they call a national work queue. Claims kind of go into just some big computer system and they're farmed out to wherever. And that's largely been a good thing. There were some real disparities in the way veterans were treated. A veteran with PTSD in Texas might get a different rating than a veteran in Florida with the same degree of severity, just because the regional differences. So the national work queue was thought to kind of iron out some of those differences. And by and large, it has. There's still some real disparities that need to be addressed, but we can practice anywhere. As long as we have a license in any jurisdiction and you have to go through a VA accreditation process, it's really, time is the key thing with the VA. If you're licensed as an attorney, you're going to get accredited by the VA. It's just going to take the time that it takes the VA to get through that application process. But short of that, I know a good friend of mine who practices at the Veterans Court in the Federal Circuit. He's living in Spain right now and works and submits his claims. And he's having a heck of a time proving up the cost of living changes for his fee from Spain, but that's a whole separate thing altogether. But he's able to practice and do everything remotely. We see veterans all over the country. I've got clients in Thailand. I've got clients in Germany. Everywhere that a veteran is, we can represent them. And that's nice, especially during this last pandemic where we're kind of restricted geographically. Our practice did not suffer because we still had the flow of clients all over the world.
Your practice, the scope of it kind of reminds me of immigration to some degree, because once you're in an immigration, you can pretty much practice on a national scale. And I hear sort of echoes of having talked to some immigration lawyers over time, where you can literally represent someone from anywhere, not only from anywhere you physically, but also the client. And so, and we see this trend toward nationalization of practices. And it seems like you and your practice area, you're ahead of the curve.
I think it's a good trend. I mean, it's going to be difficult to do in a lot of practice areas, right? I mean, you don't necessarily want an attorney from Oregon helping you. I don't even think I pronounced that correctly, but you don't want an attorney from Wisconsin representing you in a Texas personal injury suit. They may not know the law, right? But in areas that are federal in nature, like immigration, it makes sense to have that kind of broad geographic access. And there are a lot of similarities to immigration. I'm not familiar with it personally, but we work really close with University of Arkansas's Bowen School of Law to develop a program to teach law students how to represent veterans. And the professor in that program is a former immigration attorney, and she's always commenting about the eerie parallels between immigration and veterans law.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like even the administrative sort of level and then through the appellate process too, that there's a lot of parallels just from my sort of quasi-layperson standpoint.
Yep. And that can benefit an attorney practicing in this area too, because there's some very key parallels between Social Security disability and veterans law, immigration law and veterans law. And you can take advantage of those as a practitioner to diversify your practice by working with veterans who are having difficulty with immigration issues and also their disability, or veterans have issues with Social Security and also their VA claims. You can kind of overlap and kill two birds with one stone, I suppose, is the best metaphor I can come up with.
How does the fee side work? Because I imagine you work with a lot of very financially vulnerable clients.
We do. And there's two primary fee structures. So when you're working at the what we call the agency level, which is the initial slash supplemental claim and appeal to the Board of Veterans Appeals, that's an administrative process. And when a veteran wins their claim, they're paid what we call past due benefits, what they sometimes call back pay. But they're paid from the date of their claim all the way up until the date of the decision. So if a veteran's 100% disabled in a decision that came out today, but they filed their claim a year ago, they would get a year's worth of that 100% rating. So we charge our fee as a contingency percentage of that. So the VA's got a program for attorneys that will allow them to have the VA collect a fee as long as it's not above 20%. They'll collect it for the attorney, and that helps the attorney ensure that they can get some funds while they're building their practice without having to worry about trying to collect it from a veteran who, as you mentioned, is often very economically challenged at the time. When you get to the court, though, you have the opportunity to get fees. If you substantially prevail in a court appeal, you have the opportunity to apply for fees under the Equal Access to Justice Act. And the hourly rates are not that stellar. I've been licensed since 2003, so what's that, 19 years as an attorney, and my hourly rate is somewhere around $220 an hour for EJA purposes. So that's really, really low. But you can get in these cases, and if you put the work into the case, and if you stand behind your fee application, when you make that fee application, you can make a very, very profitable practice doing this. I don't like necessarily talking about that in the sense of profit. I think attorneys have to get more comfortable doing that, but it's completely possible to build that kind of a practice.
You have to talk about it. I mean, from a standpoint of having a law firm or running a law practice of your own is expensive. People don't always appreciate what goes into just setting up the ability to practice. You know, I'm sure your clients individually, that's not their frame of reference. But you mentioned scale earlier. Are you able to kind of apply scale concepts to your practice so that you can represent your clients more efficiently? And how does that affect your fee application? Or if the Equal Access to Justice Act, is it like a lodestar kind of analysis? Because you're talking then about measuring your worth based on hours spent, and that's not always the true value of your services, right?
That is 100% correct. And I think there's two pieces to that. I think looking at the court practice side of it, we are kind of locked into that lodestar formula, and the Veterans Court has established how they calculate that fee. Cost of living adjustment based off of, I think it's on the 1996 rates of $125 an hour or something along those lines. You adjust it based on cost of living, and then you're selling your time. Is that the best way to compensate an attorney for appellate work? I really, truly, the more I do this, the more I think that lodestar formula tends to preserve some disparity and preserve some, just say, favoritism for certain groups in the law, and makes it a challenge. And I'd love to see the court exploring different ways to compensate attorneys for that. But it's going to be a long time before we shift a court that's very, very young in a lot of respects, but very conservative in a lot of other respects. It's going to take a lot to move to that. But I'd love to see fixed fee appellate work. I'd love to see that it's more based on stages or phases of appellate proceedings, because they don't all go to oral argument, right? So It is something we have to talk about, though. And that's the first piece of your question is, I had mentioned earlier, I had this sleep apnea practice where we focused on scaling out sleep apnea appeals. And financially, it was a great practice area. The firm was doing great financially, but I didn't have the first clue how to manage business. And it was because of that, that firm, that first iteration of the firm collapsed. And so since then, I'm more eager to learn the business side of things and to understand how it works. And I do my best to explain that to our clients, how that business aspect works, because I think they have to understand what they're paying for. It's not something that you just call up a veteran and say, oh, we won your case, give us 30%. I think they need to understand how much went into that, that there's a lot of infrastructure in a firm to be able to do this kind of work and to do it well.
So let's talk about that a little bit. I mean, at the first level of the claim, is it more you're just kind of doing the documents? Is it evidentiary? Are there hearings? I guess kind of, if you don't mind, explain the process in a little more detail, what sort of things you actually do at each level.
Yeah, absolutely. I could go really thick in the weeds, and I'm going to spare you guys that torture, because it is a very, very, I want to say draconian process for claims and appeals. That may not be the best descriptor, but it is incredibly cumbersome for a lot of veterans. It starts with filing a claim with the VA. We used to file them with the regional office. They can take anywhere from, I've seen them decided in 2 weeks. I've seen them take 2 years to decide a claim, the initial claim. And that's basically, not a lot of attorneys work at that level for a couple of reasons, because first of all, you can't charge a fee in a claim at the agency level until the VA issues its first decision. So they get a first bite at the apple, so to speak. That's one reason. The bigger reason is that there's this whole network of veteran service officers around the country with organizations like the VFW, DAV. There's county veteran service officers in Texas are amazing. And they have relationships inside the VA and often have offices right down the hall from the Raiders. And so they're able to move and do things in claims that attorneys can't. And so we kind of leave that territory to them. They excel at it. They do a great job. And we see all the folks who are disappointed when they get their decision and need to appeal. We don't see the ones that the VSOs did right by and got the claim granted initially. And that is a very large portion of claims. But once you get that decision, there are used to be a pretty linear appeal process. You file a notice of disagreement with the VA, and then they package your appeal. You go through a process of perfecting this appeal through certain filings, and then it goes to the board. You can request a hearing or not, and that used to be the process. By 2015, that process was bogged down. They had, like, I think it was something like close to 500,000, maybe, claims in backlog and appeals in backlog. They called it the hamster wheel, because the case would get up to the board would say, oh, things have changed because it's been sitting here for 8 years. The disability's changed. We need more evidence. They'd send it back. They'd get more evidence. They go all the way back up. I was representing World War II veterans when I first started that had been in this process. One of them had been in the process. In fact, we just lost a veteran who served in Korea. I think it was 1957 is when he left active service, and he's been pursuing his claim ever since then. It took till 1986 to get the first decision. Now, there were some bureaucratic inefficiencies that caused that. But It was those inefficiencies that Congress came about in 2017 and said, we're going to change some things. And so they changed the appeal process. And now it's very much like a three-dimensional chessboard. And so you have an opportunity. You can supplement your claim. You can have a senior review officer look at it. You can file three different types of appeals to the board. If your claim has some connection to the old, what we call legacy process, you can use that process too. So it really is a complicated process, which can be both intimidating and exciting, because you can learn how to use process and procedure to your client's advantage. Those claims and appeals, the claims, most of them, like I said, they can decide them in as quick as 2 weeks. Some take 2 years. On average, I think most of the time we're seeing decisions on original claims within 4 to 9 months. And then most appeals to the board are in the old process, 5 to 8 years just to get to the board, to have a hearing or to have a decision on the record without a hearing. Now we're looking at probably somewhere in the 3 to 5 year range. they still have an incredible backlog of the old style, the old legacy appeals that they just can't get out from under. And it's a daunting process. There's a lot of bureaucratic inefficiencies. There's a cultural problem inside the VA. It takes a while to get through it. But to answer your question about what the lawyer is doing in that process, when we get a ratings decision from a vet said, I don't think I should be rated at 0% for my PTSD, I can't even get to work. What we do is we take that decision, we make the procedural choice, and then we develop the appeal. And a lot of times that means getting statements from mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters, army buddies, golfing buddies, anybody that can witness the impact of the disability, getting medical records, packaging that up and having independent medical examiners look at this and render opinions on relationship to service and severity of disability. And then we file those packages either with the agency or with the board, depending on which chessboard we want to jump onto.
So it's not an appeal in the sense of like you have a record that goes and they just look at the record. You can actually supplement an evidence and kind of bolster your claim.
Right. Now, each of those different chessboards has different determinations of what the record is. So, for example, if you want to have certain types of appeals, either what they call a higher level review, or if you want to have a direct review by the board, you're locked into the evidence that was in the record at the time of the decision. Others on appeal, you can supplement the record within certain windows of time. The record in VA claims is really just, I'm just going to go ahead and say it's a shoebox. Everything that happens in that claim goes into a big file, or it used to actually literally be a box that they would put the paper in a box and then you would request a claims file and you get the same veteran that was a World War II vet I was telling you about. We got his claims file and it was 10 big boxes, those paper ream boxes, 10 of them just full of paper that we had to sort through, figure out what it was. And
wow,
there's not a whole lot of chain of custody about what actually is in the record, when it got there, how it got there, who put it there. It can be for attorneys that like solving puzzles like that. This practice area presents no end of those puzzles.
The three-dimensional chessboard. At first, I didn't understand what you meant. I had this vision of Spock and Star Trek, right?
But what it feels like.
The way you just described it, it makes a whole lot more sense to me now. So that sort of that first level of the Board of Disciplinary Appeals, but then I think you mentioned the process as you go from there to the U.S. Court of Veterans Claims, and you're in a real court at that point, right? Because one thing I was thinking about, Chris, as you were talking was, okay, at what point are we actually dealing with less of an administrative proceeding and more of a court proceeding? It sounds like maybe that's the step, is when you go up to the U.S. Court of Veterans Claims. So how does that process work? You want to just talk about that for a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. And you're exactly correct. Because once you get a board decision, what they call a final board decision in a case, you have an opportunity. You can go back and file a new claim and start the whole hamster wheel over. Or you can appeal to the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. We call it the CAVC. Some folks call it the CAVC or the Veterans Court. And it was created by Congress, so it's a congressional court. And I think there's 9 active judges and several senior and retired judges that are still handling cases. But it is a traditional appellate court in every sense of the phrase. I think they're still so traditional that they're kind of stuck on page limits in their briefs. They haven't moved on to word counts. But that's okay. We'll deal with that. But it is an appellate process. You're looking at taking this board decision and arguing to the court whether or not they failed to consider a legal theory, whether that was arbitrary, capricious, whether a factual determination was clearly erroneous. You're looking at traditional standards of review and traditional appellate law issues.
That was my question, was standards of review and how all that works. That's helpful to hear. And going through a traditional briefing process, then it sounds like based on the administrative record.
Yeah, so I think we could break it down and appeal to the Veterans Court. Kind of, I would say I'd break it down into 4 phases probably. And the first phase is what I call the record development phase. The VA's attorneys, they've got the Office of General Counsel up there in Washington, D.C. They send us an electronic copy of, quote unquote, the record. And then we look through it and try to make determinations about whether or not it's complete, whether there are things missing, kind of duke that out a little bit. And then once that's done, it moves to the next phase. I want to call it more of a mediated resolution type phase, but basically you draw up a mini brief, a 10-page summary of the issues, try to cut really to the heart of the issue of the case and try to persuade the government's attorney that the proper thing to do is to join together in a motion to remand the appeal back to the board to fix some evidentiary or procedural or factual error. And I think the last numbers I looked at is something like 70 or 80% of the appeals at the court go back on a joint motion to remand. It's a pretty significant number, and that just speaks to how many errors the board makes. 80% of board decisions have either an error of fact or an error of law, And we have an opportunity to have them address that through the joint motion to remand phase.
That's your opportunity, really, it would seem, to make a difference for your client as an advocate, is identifying those errors and pointing them out and bringing them not only to the court, but also, it sounds like, to the government's lawyer.
It's tricky because there's some competing interests going on there. So when I get a case and I look at it and I take my mini brief, or we call it Rule 33 memo is what we would call it, but take it to the government's attorney to talk about it. In any case, there's so many mistakes by the board that there's enough mistakes in there to support a remand back to the board, which is a fee generating decision. And so in theory, I could argue that there's an error and needs to go back. That error may not actually fix the veteran's problem, though. It may just be kind of going back for some administrative thing that won't end up fixing anything, changing anything, all except generating a fee for an attorney. And so our firm focuses on looking for errors in these cases that are going to have an impact. And a lot of times those issues are statutory interpretation, regulatory interpretation, failure to consider the correct law, failure to apply the correct law, those traditional appellate issues that don't really kind of lend well to remand. And so we end up briefing a lot of cases and moving out of that phase of an attempted resolution and into the actual brief where we can fix the problem. To me, it's kind of a double-edged sword. I had one case where we were offered a remand in a case, but we had a real significant statutory interpretation issue that needed to be resolved. And the client and I went back and forth for weeks trying to decide, do we go to briefs on this and argue the interpretation issue, or do we take the remand, get you back there, have an opportunity to fix it with an open record? Those decisions are really tough because it puts the attorney's interest sometimes in getting a quick fee against the veteran's interest, or the veteran's interest in getting a quick outcome versus taking a long time to get a better outcome. It's a lot to consider.
Right. Does that court have like a rendition power? Like you mentioned statutory interpretation. Is that always going to be a remand for the board to reconsider under the correct interpretation of the statute? Or is there ever a time, I guess is what I'm asking, where you get exactly what you want out of the Court of Veterans Claims and your client's case is over to his or her benefit at that point?
Yes. So the Veterans Court has the authority to grant relief ranging from the remand authority. They can reverse the determinations of the board. In certain scenarios, they can affirm the decision. They can find error and affirm on harmless error grounds. There's some writs that you could pursue there. The petition for writ of mandamus is an option that's open for unreasonable delays in the underlying proceeding. But yeah, the court does not like using its power to reverse. And it's kind of been a bone of contention with practitioners is that I think probably out of 100 clients that we take to the court, I bet 30% of them end up back at the court because the board made a subsequent error after the initial remand. In fact, some of our clients have been back 3-4 times because the board just can't get the factual findings correct, or at least not correct, but just made. They can't make the factual finding. They can't address the correct law. And so it gets questionable whether that remand power really is doing anything, but the court is really loath to use its power to reverse. Not so much the Federal Circuit. It's very, very hard to win an appeal at the Federal Circuit. I think overall, the statistics are something like 2% of appeals at the Federal Circuit get a written decision. Most of them are Rule 36 or issued a decision without an opinion or a decision. And you just get this blank form that says appeal denied under Rule 36. Most of them are like that. But when the Federal Circuit does issue a decision, they are not hesitant to use their reversal power if they feel it's appropriate. We just won a case. It was late last year. We've been working on it for about 5 years and involving a veteran who was exposed to some chemicals while he was in Desert Storm. And those chemicals caused some pretty significant endocrine disruptions resulting in weight gain. So he was trying to service connect to what ended up being pretty disabling level of obesity. And the VA said, well, obesity is not a disability. And so we fought several years to get all the way up to the Fed Circuit. They agreed with our position, not necessarily that obesity is always going to be a disability, but it's something that the VA should consider. And so they were willing to reverse the board in that case and say, we're reversing your finding that obesity is not a disability. And we're not saying it is, but you have to consider it. So they're far more inclined to use their power to reverse than the Veterans Court.
When the stakes are high, decisions must be made quickly. And Court Surety Bond Agency is here to help. As the nation's leading surety agency specializing in supersedious bonds, CSBA can handle any size bond ranging from a small temporary injunction bond to a $1 billion appeal bond. If your client needs protection against judgment enforcement, contact CSBA or visit courtsurety.com today.
Who are the members of the board that actually hear these things? Are they appointed? Are they government employees? Like, how do they get to be in that job?
They're federal employees. They're GS level employees. I think the actual position description is hearing officer. I don't want to speak out of turn because they've changed stuff lately, but they call themselves veterans law judges. They now show up in robes, for what that's worth, at the hearings. It's a little bit corny to me, but it is what it is. Here I am wearing a tie and I'm on a podcast, so maybe I'm the one that's being corny, but in any event, they're federal employees, attorneys. There's some really good judges, and I'll just say they're really good people, but as a whole, they are not too well trained, and there's just caseloads are very, very, very high. And so changes in the law take a very long time to get fixed at the board. And so we see some really, really, really bad decisions coming out of there, but they're just GS level employees, not even SES level.
But from there, you go to the federal circuit. And this is territory that's a little more familiar to most of us that practice appellate law, although I have yet to make an appearance in the federal circuit in my career and probably never will. So how does that work going between the Court of Veterans Claims and the federal circuit? I guess at that point, you're really getting to, well, you really are talking about traditional standards of review and traditional briefing and even word count limits as opposed to page limits and all that sort of thing. Let me ask it this way. What's the review process for the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit?
There actually used to be a federal claims tribunal. I don't remember. That was within the federal circuit's jurisdiction. And so sometimes that kind of trickles up still too. But basically what happens is you file your appeal. It's a straight up traditional fed. It's just like it would be in the Fifth Circuit, local rules aside, et cetera. It's just like any other appeal. You get in there, you file your docketing statements, you follow those rules, and you got a briefing schedule. You file your brief. You get oral argument by right in the federal circuit, which is fascinating opportunity for anybody looking to get and cut their teeth on appellate law straight away. The federal circuit is a very formal court. And even going into the courtrooms in DC inside of the Marquis Federal Building, it feels like this backdrop on my Zoom screen here is just an old law feeling to the place. Very dark, very dim, very noble wooden furniture, very kind of awesome environment to be in a lot of sense. But it is a traditional court. You get assigned a panel of three judges the morning of your oral argument. You get in there, you make your argument, you got 15 minutes, you can reserve some time for rebuttal. It's everything you expect it to be in an appellate court. And you're talking really there, the judges are hyper-focused on the standard of review at the federal circuit, as they should be, right? Not so much the veterans court. And that's something that I hope will change over time, is that they'll be more inclined to actually talk about standards of review at the veterans court and apply them rather than kind of just a, it sounds like it should be this kind of approach sometimes. But the federal circuit, they hold you to the standard of review. And that's usually the first question out of the gates in an oral argument is, what standard of review are we talking about? How is this arbitrary and capricious? How is such and such affected in terms of de novo review of this particular matter? But they do not have jurisdiction to make findings of fact. They do not have jurisdiction to make findings on applications of law to fact. Really what you're looking at when you go to the Fed Circuit is you're looking at when the Veterans Court makes an error of law or a statutory regulatory interpretation decision. And of course, constitutional issues are a fair game at the Federal Circuit. And there is a little bit broader ability to kind of get into the facts and the application of law to fact in the constitutional law setting, but it's very rare to actually have a viable constitutional basis for an appeal at the federal circuit. So it's a very traditional, very strict court. The judges there are primarily doing a lot of patent work. You can sit for the 3 hours before your argument comes up, and hopefully you can keep your energy levels up while you're listening to somebody talk about this drawing of that thing and this part and have no clue what they're talking about half the time. But they're incredibly savvy judges. I mean, to be able to do that kind of work, you have to have a very analytical brain. And it shows through in the way they approach veterans law. It's a very sophisticated intellectual experience at the federal circuit, which can be a challenge sometimes for a guy like me who's grew up in the artillery and intellect wasn't our strong suit. So it can be a little bit of a challenge at arguments, but it's always a fun time. It's always really educational to kind of, even when I get schooled by a judge, which happens from time to time more than I would like, I learn a lot from it and get better the next time.
That is just such an incredible, to me, having heard you take us through the entire process from step one to step, however you would number it, going through the federal circuit. You are doing sort of claims processing, fact development, and then taking it all the way through to what appellate lawyers think of as traditional appellate work, briefing and oral argument in a federal appellate court. So, gosh, I just had no idea the range of things that are required to do what you do. And it's so educational for us to hear about it. So I'm just grateful for you to come on and tell us about it. It's just awesome.
And what's really awesome, I mean, there's so many things that I like about it, but one of my favorite things about it is that you can kind of take whatever part of it you want. If you're practicing in this area, the entry level costs are low to get in. Mm-hmm. There's a steep learning curve to catch up with the law. But if you want to learn appellate law, you can come in low entry cost, get in, start arguing cases. It's not hard to find cases. It's not hard to get cases to do this work. You can focus entirely on the appellate law practice at the federal circuit and make a good living. You could also focus on the entire process from soup to nuts and learn how to build a case that changes law from the ground up. This case I was talking about with obesity that we won a while ago, we took that before, shortly after it was at the board, and realized from that case that we could have changed the outcome of that case at a lower level had we had an opportunity to put some evidence in the record. And so we started taking cases at the original claim level so that we could build that record, knowing that this is going to be an issue that the federal circuit is going to have to adjudicate. We can use that to develop our own appellate records as we go. And that, to me, is what the practice of law is, the practice of appellate law is seeing not just how to make the argument as to whether the lower tribunal made the proper decision, applying the standards of review, that's a piece of it, but understanding how to use facts and evidence to build the arguments in the first place is really what being, I think, an appellate lawyer should be all about.
And it seems like a place where a younger lawyer could really get a lot of great experience pretty quickly. It's not a traditional path, but it's one where there's a huge need and they could really get their feet wet in a good way.
It is. And I found out about it late in my practice. So I had mentioned earlier, I clerked with Chief Phillips. I had such a good experience doing that I went back to South Texas the next semester. And I went in to talk to Dean Gerald Treese, who just recently passed away, I think last year or the year before. But I was on one of his mock trial teams and I was like, Dean, I want to go on to do the moot court. And he's like, well, come on down, do a tryout. And so I did a little tryout for the little appellate argument. He's like, Chris, just stick with mock trial. Don't even try this stuff. So that became my MO. I had an opportunity in my own private practice then to take a case that was ironically an employment law case for a veteran who was claiming some veterans discrimination under a real small statute, very narrow statute that got up to the Fed Circuit and had an opportunity to do oral argument at Fed Circuit. I think that was 2008. So I was only practicing a couple of years and certainly only had my own firm for a couple of years. And there I was arguing before the federal circuit. If you're a practitioner out there who's new, you want to do appellate law, if you want to do statutory regulatory interpretation, this is the place to cut your teeth and you can get in really easily. There's some great mentor organizations out there. Some of the best that I've ever seen. I've not seen a single firm that we no, in this practice area that I compete with. There's no reason to compete. We all help each other because there's so many clients and so many legal issues. But yeah, if you're a new practitioner, you're having trouble finding work, as I did when I first came out of law school, the only thing I could find was doing employment law with the IRS. No shame in that. But if you want to do appellate law, there's organizations that can get you cases and put a case on your desk tomorrow. And within 4 months, you can be arguing in front of the Veterans Court of the Federal Circuit.
What are those organizations? Because if anyone's listening that has an interest, how would they go about finding those cases and organizations?
Yeah, so the first place to go is what's called the Veterans Consortium. And essentially, they do a lot of different things. But one of the things that they do is they have a program where as long as you're accredited to represent veterans and you've got a good, solid license somewhere, it's not been suspended or anything like that, what they'll do is they will assign you a case that comes through. They go into the court, they look at cases that have merit, that are veterans who are pro se, they pull those out of the court and then they assign them to attorneys. They assign a mentor that will help walk that person through. You can collect a fee under the Equal Access to Justice Act if you prevail. So you have zero marketing costs. You call up, you get a case, you look at it, you work with your mentor. Alexandra Curran is one of the partners at our firm and she's one of the mentor attorneys and teaches them how to be an appellate attorney in veterans law. That's one of the organizations. If you're wanting to be a little bit more aggressive, what I did when I first started building my appellate law practice is I would comb the docket at the Veterans Court and pro se practitioners, it has their address. And so we got our mailer approved by the Texas Bar Advertising Committee so that we could send out a letter saying, hey, we see you're pro se, we do this kind of work. If you want to talk to us, here we are. And we'd send that out. And those were some of my first cases came from those. So 25% of the cases at the Veterans Court are still pro se veterans. And that doesn't sound like a lot until you hear that there's almost 8,500 cases a year at the Veterans Court. So Wow. There is no lack of clients out there. Mm-hmm. There's other organizations I could kind of rattle off a whole list of them. The National Veterans Legal Services Program, or NVLSP, is a great program that can connect you with cases. National Organization of Veterans Advocates connect you directly with cases, but they can get you the expertise and the knowledge that you need to be able to do this. They're the gold standard. And I should say, in interest of full disclosure, I am on the board of directors for that organization. So everything that I say that's good about them comes from that. But phenomenal organizations. There's a lot of state organizations. You can reach out to your county VSO. Most VSOs or veteran service officers will not represent veterans in court. There's a lot of reasons for that. But when they get their decision from the board, these organizations have no place to send them to. So you can go into your county VSO and start building that relationship and say, hey, when you get a BVA decision, let me take a look at it with the veteran. Let me see if there's a basis for an appeal. Take it. And if you substantially prevail at the court, you can apply for fees under the Equal Access to Justice Act. So,
okay.
Yeah, that's super helpful to hear. Well, thanks for taking us through that, Chris. We're kind of transitioning now as we sort of get ready to wrap up. But one thing I know that you had expressed interest in talking about, it's the topic that's we've talked about many times on our podcast, and it's really important to continue to keep in public discussion, and that's wellness in the legal profession. And you indicated that your firm has taken sort of a unique approach to this. Will you talk to us about that a little bit?
So I think the usual approach to things related to attorney wellness, when you go and try to read something, you have a problem, you have an issue you're dealing with, and you get online or you go to talk to somebody, the solutions are usually directed at the individual that's suffering from the condition or the experience. I believe that firm owners, business owners, have at least as large, if not a larger share in solving that problem. And so we have taken that approach at our firm, is that we are going to prioritize our employees' wellness as a primary focus of what we do, whether it be through the pay system. I'm a firm believer in feeding the ox that treads the corn, but also in terms of doing the things for employees that give them the space. They're giving us 25% of their lives, just if they even work a minimum 40-hour week. They're giving us 25% of their lives. I can't give them ownership. I would love to be able to give some of our paralegals ownership in a firm because they contribute just as much to it. So what we do in exchange is we try to create opportunities for wellness. And those are, we pay 100% of their premiums for any kind of healthcare. We get them a good benefits program there. We shut down the firm at the end of the year from first week in December to the end of the year. We close down and we give everybody pay for those 3 weeks to go and spend time with their families, to be with their families over the holidays without having to worry about work. Now, somebody's got to kind of cover the phones and do all the little things to kind of check the blocks, and we sure. rotate that to keep it fair. But that's one of the things. We give paid federal holidays. We've got paid family leave. We make sure that whatever benefit an owner could take advantage of, that should be available to our employees as well. And then we've got programs. We recently signed up with Headspace to make mindfulness meditation tools available to all of our employees for free. They can get on there. They can do that. It's been a game changer in my life, in my practice, and I want to pass that on. But I think there's a lot of things that firms can do beyond just those small gestures of paying people what they're worth. You know, it's not necessarily a small gesture, but I think that there's things that we can do to systemically change the way the legal profession operates so that we're putting our wellness first. You can be involved in a conflict, as lawyers always are, right? Without having to sacrifice your mental, physical, financial, emotional health. Those are things that are important. And I don't think you can put the client first without putting your own wellness first.
Mm-hmm. Totally agree.
Yeah, that's great to hear. I commend you for prioritizing your folks' wellness, because you're right. Staff, support staff, paralegals tend to be underappreciated in our profession. And so I admire the way you all are handling that. That's really, I would say, cutting edge even.
I hope more firms pick it up. A big selling point of our firm when we're hiring is that 3 week break at the end of the year. I mean, I don't know of another law firm that does that. I don't know of any businesses that really do that. But if it works sure. in France and Germany, that you can take a summer off, why can't you take the holidays off here? Why can't you give people an opportunity to recharge their batteries? There's ways to do it. There's challenges associated with doing things like that. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of clients who are victims of military sexual trauma, and that can be very difficult to represent those individuals because sometimes that trauma can rub off on the legal assistant or the paralegal or the attorney, and providing the tools, frankly, just being aware that that could happen and that an employee's outburst or an employee's lateness or an employee's absence from work or missing timelines or whatever the case may be, that it could trace back to that. And I think it's the employer's responsibility to say, we're giving you this work to do. We're going to give you favorable conditions to do it in, and we're going to take care of you through the process. And We had a doc come on and we did a Zoom chat with our whole firm. And she came out and chatted to us for about an hour about how to separate ourselves from our clients' trauma so that we could do those cases. And just the reactions that we got from some of the staff, attorneys and paralegals alike, to be able to say, I'd never thought that I could do that. I never thought that I could say no to something. And so now we got a lot of employees coming to us and saying, no, I can't do that case. But I say this somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but it is true. I mean, everybody, you start to realize that the cases that we handle, even whether it's veterans law, it translates to employment law, immigration, any kind of law, family law, particularly criminal law, you're in the middle of a fight with a person who is in probably one of the worst experiences of their life. And there's just no way that that's not going to rub off on you. And we've got a couple of ways to cope with that. You can cope with a bottle, a needle, a snort, or you could cope with it by doing some different things and changing the way, not just the person. I can go and I can learn mindfulness meditation. I can go hire a therapist and work with a therapist. I'm talking from the employer's perspective, is that we have to recognize that when we hire attorneys to do a criminal law case or a family law case, that we're putting them in the trenches of a fight that they may not have the tools that they're equipped to handle. And it's on us to give them those tools.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Good for y'all for being so forward thinking and just keeping that as kind of the forefront, because it is so important. And it's something that is just now starting to get talked about in legal circles, and we've seen the impact of it for so long. So kudos to y'all.
It's been an experience and we're hoping to continue to expand and do some more things. I like practicing law this way far better than I like practicing law. And I'll tell you, and I'll just plant the seed with your listeners out there, it's far more profitable to do this too. There's some costs associated with it, of course, but the profit gains that you get out of it are staggering. Mm-hmm. You know, having a healthy, well firm with healthy, well people, or trying to be healthy, well, I should say it that way, really does improve productivity, improves efficiency. People think outside the box better. There's more abstract creative thinking. We get some really cool stuff from our employees who are looking at a case. They've had a time to take a day or two off and collect themselves. They come back in fresh rather than stressed out. It's a far more profitable way to operate, I think.
We're kind of reaching the end, but our tradition has always been to end with a tip or a war story. So I don't know if you've got one you want to share with us, but we'd love to hear it if you do.
Man, I probably could bore you with all of them. I don't know. I think
I think there's a few.
I think probably the number one thing that I would say is when talking to folks about appellate law is I think I did not come to this through any natural gift of writing, any natural gift of speaking or arguing. If anything, I tend to be a little bit too punchy, flamboyant, and that is not what appellate law is necessarily designed to be. And so I would encourage attorneys that are getting into this to spend some time learning the craft. There is a lot of good material out there in terms of one of my favorite, I keep it on my desk side, is, and I'm going to mispronounce his name, but Judge Aldersert's Winning on Appeal. I go to that. This thing is tattered and torn. I've gone to it so many times, almost every brief I'm in there trying to figure out how to better apply my craft, learning from other folks. You had a speaker on a few. It might have been, I don't think it was the last session or the one before. I can't remember exactly when, but she was talking about teaching new attorneys how to learn formulas for new practice areas, essentially. And she was talking about how you pull briefs in bankruptcy court to get a sense of what the customs and norms are and do those sorts of things. That would be the number one thing that I would say is learn the craft, put the time in. It's fascinating. It can be really, really, really fun. Don't be afraid to do things. I think one of the first briefs that I had, I was trying to be cute and put some goofy Dr. Seuss joke in there and have regretted it ever since. But don't be afraid to do those things because that's how we learn. We learn by making mistakes. And as long as our mistakes don't get people killed, we're probably going to be okay from them. So make mistakes and learn from them. That would be my number one advice on the appellate side. Broader than that, one thing that I've learned in the practice of law, I started my life in a very different place than I'm at now, in the sense that I started out, I kind of grew up in a family that was extremely conservative, I will say it that way, and am not that. And I've learned over time that finding the dignity into the individual human being is critical. And it's changed the way I practice law. And so I would just encourage other employers out there to focus less on the bottom line and focus more on the dignity of the individual, of the folks they're working with. And I think that they will find that they will have a much more profitable and fun practice. So those aren't necessarily war stories. Those are just kind of lessons learned. But it's okay. I'm sure I could tell you a war story or two, but I don't want to bore you.
Well, we really appreciate it. And we appreciate your time. And thanks so much for sharing with us today. This has all been super interesting stuff.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. I hope it makes for an entertaining show. And I look forward to seeing your guys' continued work. You guys are amazing. What you're doing, not just for appellate law, but just for anybody who wants to learn how to interview a podcast, I would recommend that they listen to yours just to see how to actually interview a guest in a comfortable and conversational way.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.